However, mainly today, I'll be talking about some recent research, a slight side project, perhaps, I've been doing, which looks at the use of reptiles and amphibians in forms of therapeutic process, and the roles of these more unfamiliar species, perhaps, in contributing to experiences of health and place. I'll hopefully demonstrate how, compared to conventional mammalian-based animal-assisted therapies and interventions, cold-blooded species can create very different effective encounters within interspecies therapeutic practice. Would help if I turned the clicker on, probably. Excellent, good. So geographers have traditionally engaged with the idea of health and place through the analytical framework of therapeutic landscapes, which is a way of critically understanding how perceptions, reputations, and experiences of health can be associated with a spatial area. It's about not seeing space as simply a backdrop or container within which disease and treatments can occur, but instead recognising space as being an active agent in itself, capable of transforming and contributing to health experiences. Therapeutic landscapes have been described in physiological terms, generating relief from physical symptoms and assisting in reducing stress. Other utilisations of the term highlight how space can improve and support a person's emotional and social well-being. Indeed, therapeutic landscapes are often described as being as much about social opportunities as they are medicinal. Later uses of the concept have demonstrated how, rather than explicitly providing a curative factor, therapeutic landscapes are often framed as supporting a maintenance of health and well-being, or even providing opportunities for an individual's capacity building. More recently, again, there's been a move to refer simply to therapeutic spaces, dropping the landscape aspect of the concept, recognising the role of the more than terrestrial spaces which can impact on health and well-being. However, to date, there's been very little research exploring the role of non-humans in therapeutic landscapes. Animals have instead been subsumed into the broader concept of nature or the environment. I'm interested in considering the role of heterogeneous actants in co-producing the becoming therapeutic of particular spaces, bringing the animals back into discussions of therapeutic spaces, and recognising animals as animals with lives of their own, rather than some constituent parts of nature or the environment. The idea of therapeutic landscapes and therapeutic spaces provides an interesting way to begin to think about human-animal relations, particularly about how animals can be mobilised in practices of care and health creation. There's a wide body of literature which has catalogued the health benefits which non-humans can affect for humans, leading Beck and Katcher to summarise that there is solid evidence that animal contact has significant health benefits and that it positively influences transient physiological states, morale, and feelings of self-worth. Animals can facilitate human social contact, whether from simply talking about a fleeting encounter with an animal whilst walking through some sand dunes, to discussing one's own companion and pet animals, and finding common ground with others. Whilst actively being involved in the care of an animal can create a purposeful routine for many people. Animals are responsive and tactile. They can satisfy human emotional needs or provide a diversion and distraction from everyday stresses. For some people, simply observing animals can be therapeutic. Animals as well function as a powerful semiotic force which can influence our perceptions and experiences of place and well-being. There are various ways in which non-human life is used within therapeutic spaces. In the UK, there are around 4,500 active pets as therapy dogs, visiting over 130,000 people per week in various spaces, including hospitals and care homes. More than 180 UK farms function as care farms, combining agricultural production with health, social, and educational services. There's a growing amount of multi-species reading programs where both children and adults learn to read by reading to animals in rescue shelters, helping the animals to become socialized to human companionship in the hope of finding a permanent home, whilst allowing the human participants to overcome barriers to learning to read. Excellent. Indeed, using animals to help create therapeutic space may also be happening closer than you think. Here at Cardiff University, once a year, the student union creates a petting zoo at one of our main libraries to help students who are feeling stressed out about revision and exams. These types of events seem to be becoming commonplace at British higher education institutions. Nottingham Trent, Aberdeen and Central Lancashire have offered puppy rooms in the past for similarly stressed out students. What's interesting about those examples compared to here in Cardiff is that they work with guide dog puppies. So again, similar to the multi-species reading programmes, there's possibly an element of cross-species benefit. However, all of these types of initiatives exclusively work with mammalian species, and occasionally avian, if we're thinking about care farm context, where there might be some chickens hanging around. Cold-blooded creatures have been marginalised within therapeutic spaces, to the point where one of my participants in this piece of research contacted a leading pets as therapy organisation to see if he could get involved using his snakes and reptiles as therapy animals. And he was told, dogs and cats are the only animals with therapeutic value. But should we be writing off whole species, groups and classes of animals because of some inherent difference and our lack of familiarity with them? To quote Franklin Gin, we must be careful not to sideline invisible, uncomfortable and unloved species, because, as I'll hopefully demonstrate, some of these cold-blooded species and animals come to be loved very much. It's perhaps unsurprising that the animals that we've commonly turned to for use within therapeutic practice and spaces are the species that we're already most comfortable and familiar with. I was curious as to how cold-blooded species could come to be mobilised to create a therapeutic landscape and encounter, and the difference which came about as a result of their cold-bloodedness. This is still fairly early research, informed primarily by a series of interviews at the moment. I'm hoping to go out and do some more ethnographic work in future, which will be fun because I'm terrified of snakes. So we'll deal with that when it comes. So I've been working with several organisations that actively use cold-blooded species as part of structured therapeutic engagements, bringing snakes, lizards, frogs and more into a variety of spaces of care, including closed psychiatric wards, care homes and special educational schools. The organisations I spoke to, as the quotes on the screen demonstrate, started out using the more traditional therapy animals to create therapeutic spaces, dogs, cats. But upon talking to patients and experimenting with different species, they found that people had a preference and indeed an interest in engaging with these more exotic and unfamiliar species. People's reactions and engagement with animals is highly individual. People are active agents in co-producing place. Thus, what constitutes a therapeutic space for one may not for another. There's a need to think about this in the context of introducing animals into therapeutic spaces. Relationships and encounters between animals are multi-determinant. In this way, there's a need to consider people's preference. People are unique and individual. They have specific interests and personal predilections. Past experiences with certain species may result in a desire to engage with certain animals, but not others. As one practitioner told me, one of the residents, one of the homes I visit, she doesn't like any furry animals at all. She likes tortoises, and that's the only animal she'll entertain, is a tortoise. Animals allow people to retain their connections to their culture, identity, and past experiences. For some people, this may be having some chickens in a retirement home to allow links to an agricultural past. Yet for others, it may be something like getting to sit with a tortoise again. Regardless of the more unusual species of therapy animal discussed in this example, it's still very much the animal's familiarity that helps create a therapeutic encounter and space. Whilst with other audiences, it's actually the specific use and playing upon the unfamiliarity and the unfamiliar nature of certain species that allows those working in therapeutic practice to tap into a level of fascination. As the top quote points out, there are generational differences in knowledge, interest, and familiarity with animals. As one practitioner told me, you find the kids quite like the edgy animals, like the giant millipedes and the frog and the snakes and the lizards. They've been brought up with a different kind of pet ideal to the people in their sort of 30s and 40s who've been brought up with the usual furry kind of thing. It's quite a different ballgame when you're dealing with them. Animals are also culturally coded. Associating with certain species or breeds can impact on a person's social identity. One of the practitioners I interviewed discussed how he's noticed that, especially with younger men, their desire to appear macho, to some extent, forces them to engage and interact in the therapeutic process when scary or exotic animals are used in order to keep up appearances. When you brought a snake in, suddenly these guys were engaging with the snakes, Probably because it had a bit more kudos. There's a need to be aware of this when thinking of the types of animals to introduce into therapeutic space. Some animals may simply not have the desired effects. The kudos that the quote talks about shows how the use of more unfamiliar cold-blooded species can actually help to create a therapeutic space where more traditional animals may have failed. Another practitioner described normal animals, the furry, four-legged variety. For a lot of the guys, somehow, that kind of didn't scratch where it itched for them. It didn't. It wasn't something that they were willing to engage with. By going beyond the more traditional interpretation of companion animals and viewing, as Donna Haraway does, that there exists a much wider variety of species which may become companionable, there are opportunities to create additional therapeutic encounters and spaces and engage groups and individuals in therapeutic practices who may otherwise fail to participate. There are also practical reasons that certain practitioners choose to use cold-blooded and reptilian species when they were seeking to kind of create this therapeutic space. There was one patient, she can't go anywhere near a cat because it brings her out in rashes and sneezes and all sorts of stuff. So there's all these different considerations you have to make. In the UK, pets are the second most important cause of allergy in the home. Half of all asthmatic children are allergic to cats, whilst 40% are allergic to dogs. And whilst it is possible to have an allergic reaction to reptilian species of animals, it's much less common. Animals such as snakes and lizards allow those with severe allergies to still be able to partake in animal-assisted therapy activities and not be excluded because of their bodily reactions to being in a multi-species environment. However, phobias and negative past experiences with animals may result in different experiences to animals' presence in therapeutic spaces, ultimately creating spaces which are therapeutic to certain social groups and individuals, but perhaps not others. This need to think about fear and disgust of certain species becomes increasingly important when we're talking about these more unusual or perhaps more unknown species, such as snakes and other cold-blooded creatures. According to Isbell, as many as one-third of adults are ophidiophobic, as Emily talked about earlier, afraid of snakes. The anecdote here is quite powerful. They knew there was a girl that was really frightened of snakes. But they thought they better warn her that we were going in, as we were going to be there, she was going to be in the group. So they said there was a snake coming in. And basically she completely, at the word snake, she freaked out. She was struggling with things like asthma attacks, she was having palpitations, panic attacks, sick, off of food, not sleeping for the 2 days before we came. There's just the potential for the simultaneous creation of restorative places and scary spaces, and the othering of those who have specific and different reactions to animals, creating tensions and politics at play within these therapeutic spaces. In many kinds of animal encounter, there's the possibility for bites, anaphylaxis, parasites, and poorly tempered animals. The potential for these exists across multiple species, but the human fear of a negative encounter seems to be heightened when discussing reptiles and snakes. As one practitioner told me, somehow a snake bite is far more sinister and dangerous than a cat ripping your skin off with its claws. When in fact a snake bite actually does cause a lot less damage than a cat bite or a scratch. It's obviously perhaps some slight bias here. As that's not to say that snake bites don't happen when you begin to introduce snakes and lizards into therapeutic spaces. The animals are perhaps a little less shy about expressing their agency than more traditional therapy animals. In the example at the bottom, I won't read it all, but there was a patient in a closed psychiatric ward who was trying to hold the snake still and stop it from moving because he wanted to give the snake a kiss. Unfortunately, the snake gave him a kiss first. It was fine. Everyone was fine. Which brings us nicely on to looking at some of the challenges of using cold-blooded animals within animal-assisted therapies. Perhaps the biggest challenge of using reptilian and cold-blooded species for these kind of therapeutic encounters is their unpredictability and the lack of ability to perhaps train or assess a snake or lizard for therapy work in the same way that a dog may be. Pets as therapy dogs go through a fairly rigorous training and assessment exercise. Obviously, the animals are, to a certain extent, desensitized to handling and more used to being out of a vivarium than typical members of their species. one practitioner said that if I'm taking a snake with me and I go in and their body language tells me they don't want my hand in their vivarium, then they obviously don't want to go in a box and go and visit a care home and go and visit a psychiatric hospital. So what instead becomes crucial is the dwelt knowledge of the practitioners and their relationships with the animals on an individual basis. Their lived knowledge and experience of each individual reptile, its temperaments and tolerances, a learning to become affected through a long-term relationship, sensitive to another species' habits and behaviours, and in particular, changes in these. The practitioners were acutely aware of this. One of them told me, you've got to kind of understand the psychology of the animal as well, and know what the animal can put up with, and what the animal will put up with. Some of the practitioners had had their animals for over 16 years, becoming attuned to the animal as an individual. It's also worth recognising that there are perhaps species-level limitations to involving some of these cold-blooded species in these kind of therapeutic processes and spaces. As the quote says, snakes and lizards haven't got the same kind of tolerance for being stroked in the same way that a dog might enjoy being stroked and fussed over all day. Similarly, tolerance for handling is much lower, particularly as some of the species require, if not specific technique, then at least a level of confidence. Some of the smaller lizard species were handled purely by the practitioners, there purely to evoke a form of visual fascination rather than a physical hands-on encounter. The activities participants can engage in with reptiles tend to be much more limited than dogs. You can't generally use toys with a reptile, at least not in the same way as with a dog. Something like a monitor lizard might perhaps be an exception here, but I've not met anyone that uses one of those for therapeutic work, sadly. You see people walking monitor lizards in the park in America sometimes. The therapeutic opportunities from using cold-blooded animals are often more mental and emotional than physical. And that's something I just want to pick up on to finish. The unfamiliarity of the animals, the alienness and the fear that is often associated with them actually becomes quite important for their therapeutic effect. Getting participants to encounter an animal that they find fearful is used to a benefit by the practitioners and the other healthcare staff they work with. By getting service users to confront and engage with the animal, it creates a model which can then be used to discuss other challenges and barriers within a participant's life. I think the quote sums it up quite well. They knew what it was to be seriously afraid of the animal, but they also knew what it was to have overcome that fear. In terms of this confidence building, it perhaps wouldn't work if instead it was a nice, bouncy, fluffy puppy that was brought into their therapeutic space. It's actually using the apprehension that people have with some of these cold-blooded species that makes the animal-assisted therapies work and helps to create a therapeutic space. Therapeutic spaces have the potential to contain multiple entanglements of all sorts of different organisms, all the diversity of different ways of living and being. Some of these ways of living and being include being cold-blooded. However, the introduction of a snake, lizard, frog, or any of the other myriad of cold-blooded life forms that occupy our planet does not necessarily mean the dismantling of a space's therapeutic nature. Indeed, as I've hopefully demonstrated, cold-blooded animals actually have the potential to add to the therapeutic opportunities of a place, in a similar way to the more traditionally mobilised mammalian species, such as creating interest, engagement, and stirring memories, as well as in other ways, therapeutic effects that come about distinctly as a result of certain species' individual traits and our unfamiliarity and discomfort with them. Thank you.